This honorable court, Your Honors, I've come before you today as a probate practitioner. This is a probate matter from Anderson County, Texas, in East Texas. And the paramount principle in probate law is to follow the intent of the testator. Here, the testator was a man named Jim Kappas. And he, in his will, he appointed his brother, John, as his executor and as trustee of a testamentary trust contained in his will. Under Texas probate jurisprudence, Your Honors, the hallowed principle of the right to pick your executor or your personal representative or your trustee goes back over 150 years. We referred to the In Re Estate of Roots case out of the Amarillo Court of Appeals and the Allen versus Talley case and the Boyles versus Gresham case out of this court.
What discretion, if any, does a trial judge have in a probate matter? Which
I believe
is the same type of discretion as any other state district judge, or is it different?
I believe it is the same, Your Honor. It's basically the standard of review would be an abuse of discretion, but the discretion. All the case law, the statutory law, everything points to we are charged in the probate legal system with following the intent of the testator if we can, if it's possible. And so that is a significant principle. We had quoted Professor Johansson of the University of Texas Law School because when the case was reported out of the Tyler Court of Appeals, He was working on his annotated probate court code for 2009, and he stated there is now a new case out of the Tyler Court of Appeals which affects this principle that the testator can pick who they want. In our case before the court this morning, the brother, John Kappas, was named by the testator, Jim Kappas. They were partners with their father in Kappas Farms, going back to the...
What would be the... You're arguing for trial court discretion?
Yes, Your Honor, that...
What would the factors be? Short of, obviously, if the executor was stealing from the estate or wasting the estate assets or blowing them up, they should be removed then. There wouldn't be any discretion in those situations.
We have a very elaborate set of statutes and case law that relate to removal. Removal is what I would call kind of a disfavored claim. In other words, there's a high bar. It's not just that the person annoys you or you don't like them or you don't get along.
But you'd agree with me in the examples I just gave. There would be no discretion. You would have to do it then.
I would agree if the...
Would one issue be the size of the estate? Because if this, I assume these fights are almost always between beneficiaries.
Generally speaking, but in many
instances. So the answer is going to be, if we remove the independent executor, we're probably going to have to appoint a lawyer or a bank.
Well, not necessarily. In most wills, including this one, there's a successor named.
Which is usually a lawyer or a bank.
In some cases, when people come into my office and want to do a will and they want to know what they need to tell me, the first thing we talk about is the executor needs to be the most trusted person in your life. It needs to be a responsible person. It needs to be someone that you know will carry out your wishes through rain, sleet, or snow. And that's what we have here. The brother of the decedent was his partner with his father. They own this property together. There's no dispute that record title ownership in this real estate, which was basically the sole asset of the estate.
Your trustee here?
The successor trustee here is Ms. Kappas's brother, a man named Lewis McCall.
So we're kind of out of the frying pan into the fire if this is a fight between beneficiaries.
My father would characterize this as internecine warfare.
I'm back again to what kind of factors a trial judge should use on discretion, assuming it's normally family members, and that's who the fight's between. If we remove them, we're going to end up appointing a bank or a lawyer, which if it's a small estate, is going to eat it completely up. Is that one factor the trial judge ought to consider?
Yes, it is, Your Honor, but we have...
What others?
We have the grounds in the statute as to...
But they're very broad, unsuitable. What does that mean?
Well, Your Honor, under Section 149C of the Texas Probate Code, they are actually fairly specific. There are grounds for removal of an executor. The one that generally is applied in most of the cases is gross mismanagement or gross misapplication of the estate or estate property.
But that's the removal. In the appointment of the executor or the appointing an executor pursuant to the will, the judge has an opportunity to look at that and says, well, okay, here's the one that's named. And so I have a discretion to determine whether they're suitable or not.
Yes, Your Honor. Justice Green, at the time of qualification of the executor, what applies is Section 77 of the Texas Probate Code, and it lists people in order of their priority. So, and the number one person is the person named in the will as executor.
So we're beyond that.
Yes, sir. It was not, because this executor was not challenged at the time of his appointment.
Deemed to be suitable, not disqualified by law otherwise.
He qualified under the probate code. The judge gave him letters, testamentary.
And so the question that remains is, under what criteria would he be removed? And has there been any claim here that he should have been removed for the factors described in one, was it 149C?
Not by the respondent in this case, Your Honor. That's been one of our points on appeal consistently, is that the respondent did not plead any of the statutory grounds for removal of an independent executor or of a trustee. There are two very specific statutes, 149C of the Probate Code and 113.082 of the Texas Trust Code. Those are the removal statutes.
So any claim of unsuitability would have had to have been raised at the time of the appointment?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And as a practical matter, how many other beneficiaries, what is the notice to beneficiaries at the time trustee is appointed or named suitable?
Your Honor, Chief Justice Jefferson, at the time that this will was probated in May of 2005, the requirement was for a published, posted notice at the courthouse for 10 days and notice to creditors within 30 days under Section 128A. That has since been updated, but as a practical matter in this probate proceeding, everyone was aware of what was going on. It was probated shortly after Jim's death.
I'm just trying to think of some other, you know, cases where there is a conflict, but the probate judge is not going to be aware of it. And I can imagine a circumstance where the conflict is so severe that had the judge known, that the trustee would not have been approved.
I would direct the court, Your Honor, to the findings of fact of the trial court. Finding of fact number 20, when he executed both the 2003 will and the 2004 will, decedent James Kappas knew that his brother, respondent John Kappas, owned an undivided one half of the 49-acre tract and named him independent executor with that knowledge. And then number 21.
Right, but what did he know of? Is it Sandra's interest and belief that there's a conflict of interest at that time?
Your Honor, the basic principle here is that with our number one duty to follow the intent of the testator in the probate jurisprudence, people often pick family members that they co-own property with. People often pick a business associate or a partner or someone who, on the face of it, has what could appear to be a conflict of interest. They can even pick people who have a claim against the estate. The principle is, I believe, and should be, that actual misconduct is the standard and is what is required for the draconian sanction of removal.
What does that mean exactly?
That means actually stealing.
Well, you know, they're stealing. But if there's a very direct conflict and the executor says the estate property belongs to me personally and not to the estate, and the beneficiaries disagree with that, is that enough of a conflict?
It's fact specific. And in this case, the executor was facing a removal action in what appeared to be a will contest. In the clerk's record are the pleadings, which really go on and on about the will. And only in an amended pleading filed just weeks before the trial was this issue of the valuation of the improvements.
Well, you say fact specific, but that kind of wrestling with the same questions Judge Brister was asking. What facts, if there's that direct a conflict, it's mine, no it's not. Is that enough of a conflict to disqualify a spouse or a brother or somebody?
Not here, Your Honor, because the
executor... Any case? Can you think of a case in which it would...
Oh, I certainly can. Yes, sir.
What would that entail?
Well, where you have irreconcilable conflicts, where you have like his, hers, and ours children, and you have irreconcilable conflicts between these beneficiaries...
No, let's say all the beneficiaries are united. They want it, and the executor says it's mine.
Well, then it's up for the court to decide if the executor has violated one of the statutory grounds for removal and whether removal is justified.
I'm trying to get it. How would he do that? I mean, he says it's mine. The beneficiary says it's ours. So it's just that simple. And now they're going to go litigate that. And the beneficiaries naturally would like somebody on their side to be championing their cause, and the executor is on the other side.
Here, the executor was defending a removal action, and basically at the last minute, this issue of the valuation of these improvements comes up. And I have to give some background. The decedent and the respondent here, Ms. Kappas, had just been through what can only be described as a Hatfields and McCoys barn-burning divorce, very hostile, high-conflict divorce. And so in the divorce, she was awarded a lien against Mr. Kappas, what we call in family law an oilty lien, for $4,950, and that's reflected in the trial court statement. So where she's asserting in her briefs and things before this court that should be considered here or should have been considered at the trial court, that was a moot issue.
Well, speaking as a probate professional who handles this kind of stuff every day, what protection or recourse does a beneficiary have if the executor, you know, claims ownership, as Justice Heck described, of an estate asset and tries to sell it? I mean, are you saying that unless one of the factors in the removal statute are met, then there's no protection whatsoever if there's any kind of clash between an executor who claims ownership of this asset and a beneficiary?
I believe there's significant protection, Your Honor. Justice Willett, there is considerable case law on this subject. There is the elaborate statutes. You have a very commonly recognized cause of action for removal of an administrator, an executor, a trustee, and it's a fairly frequently litigated item. But the bar is pretty high. It's not just that you don't like the person. Here, the executor was not ever contesting ownership of anything. He owned an undivided record title interest in this real estate. He was partners with the decedent. The evidence at trial was that they had all, their father, Walter, John, and the decedent, Jim, had all poured in money in this thing where they were all going to retire and built all kinds of little improvements. The improvements basically become part of the real estate. So the question would be, where else would he start but to say, you know, it's 50-50. The trial court just awarded it on a different basis without explaining what that basis was.
But your position is the only sort of protection that a beneficiary has is invoking 149C.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But if he'd started at 90-10, would that be a conflict? I'm trying to get you to be less general. You say the statute and fact specific and all this, but I'm trying to understand what would be a conflict that you think would be disqualifying. And if you say, well, he started at 50-50 because they were partners, and that's natural. But what if he'd started at 90-10? Well, then would that be a conflict?
I believe it would, Your Honor.
But would it be a conflict that violates 149C?
Yes, if he said he owned 90% of the estate, I believe that, as a matter of law, would be.
Why?
Because the beneficiaries have the right to expect a fiduciary, such as an executor, to advocate for them. And that's what Mr. Kappas, in this matter, was trying to do for his niece and nephew, because he felt that's what his brother wanted, and because he felt he was in the best position to look out for them.
So basically, it's whether the trial judge thinks the position he's asserting is in good faith or not?
That is correct, Justice Brister.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, and the trial judge declined.
That's kind of like deciding the case before it starts, isn't it?
Not necessarily. The trial judge heard the evidence. Now, because of the controversy over the will, a second will was probated just right before this trial occurred, and so the administration of this estate just really kind of started over.
This may not have anything to do with the case, but are the niece and the nephew in conflict with the mother?
I do not believe they are, Justice Medina.
So you would agree, I think you said, that if the estate were being wasted, that removal would be appropriate?
Yes, it would.
Well, if you're claiming a piece of the estate you're not entitled to, why would that not be wasting the estate?
Your Honor, again, that's not what occurred here. The executor, any personal administrator, once you're appointed, you have to do an inventory. You have to characterize assets as community or separate property. You have to assign values to those assets. Sometimes it's not easy. I've done it myself, and it's sometimes a very difficult proposition, especially with different family mixes. And so Mr. Kappas had to characterize these assets, and he had to assign values to them, and he did the best he could under the circumstances, and his presumption was clearly in good faith. He was always partners with his brother.
But that, again, sort of begs the question. I mean, if he were trying to carve out a bigger percentage of the property for himself, why is that not wasting the estate? Because it's divesting the estate of a percentage of the property itself.
At 50-50, he was not doing that, Justice O'Neill. That just did not occur here.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Swift will present argument for the respondent.
Thank you. Good morning. It's nice to be here again. It's been a while. Like the gentleman before, I was here with Justice Heck with Cipriano versus Ozarka Water. Let me begin this with an executor's a fiduciary, a trustee's a fiduciary. This case involves a tension between the conflict that arises when an executor is exercising his fiduciary duty, and that fiduciary duty gets intertwined with his own personal interest. Mr. Kappas,
here there was no finding of a breach of fiduciary duty. What's the significance of that?
Well, the appellate court made one.
I know, but the trial court didn't.
The trial court found that the conflict between the two of them over the ownership of the property created a breach of that fiduciary duty, that Mr. Kappas, as executor, cannot serve two masters.
The trial court didn't find that.
That's correct. The trial court erroneously believed and says so in its statement that can I resolve this conflict by making a division of the property?
Well, that was going to be my question. Let's say there is a conflict and the executor has a conflict. Why can't the executor represent himself in that conflict and let the trial court sort it out, which is apparently what happened here? The trial court heard his sort of conflicting claim and decided the percentages based on what he thought.
But he had the same lawyer as executor and as an individual. They presented the claims together. Okay, he's not a beneficiary under the will. He's not a beneficiary. His claim is as a co-tenant, adverse to the beneficiaries.
I understand, but so you've got a fact issue as to what where this property goes, and why can't the trial court say, look, I recognize y'all are conflicted. But I'll resolve that. I'll look at the facts and I'll hear the evidence and I'll decide that here's 48% and here's 52%. Why does removal have to resolve?
Well, because he's breached his fiduciary duty, and once a breach has occurred, you can't unring the bell. The courts have been clear on that. There's a case.
He breached his fiduciary duty because he was wrong.
Excuse me?
Wrong?
Yes.
Well, I mean, that being wrong is not necessarily a breach of fiduciary duty.
Well, he took a position adverse to the beneficiaries of the estate.
It turned out to be wrong. But is there any evidence he was in bad faith? He was making this up? He knew it was wrong?
Parts of it, yes. I asked him, for example, okay, what kind of benefit are the kids getting for the dog kennels that it was clear Ms. Kappas built? It's included in the price of the property. You're getting half of that? Correct. Do you think that's fair to the kids? My brother and I owned the estate, and I owned half of the estate. So I think he was in bad faith.
Well, what's...
And, I'm sorry?
You know, you build a fixture on a piece of real estate, there may be some contribution back and forth, but why wouldn't that be part of the estate? Why was that a wrong argument to make in terms of breach of fiduciary duty?
Because it was property that was owned by the estate.
And he owned part of the property.
He owned part of the property, and the case law is clear. You don't get what you put in it. You get an increase in the valuation. But more importantly, in this case, we heard about 149C. What happened in this case is Ms. Kappas got an injunction to prevent the sale of the property and the distribution of the proceeds on a 50-50 basis. And the distribution's clear from the inventory and appraisements that are on file that that's how I intended to distribute it. 149C says in Section 2, sufficient grounds appear to support belief that he has misapplied or embezzled, or that he is about to misapply or embezzle all or any part of the property committed to his care.
He said he owned 8.5% more than the trial court found. And she said she owned 4.5% more than the trial court found. And why aren't those just opposite sides of a dispute over where to draw the line that it doesn't have anything to do with a breach of fiduciary duty?
Well, in one sense, they are opposite sides of a dispute. I agree with you. But he has a duty, isn't it? He came into court not just as executor, but also as the co-tenant brother, and in both capacities fought the estate. If he had come to court simply as the co-tenant brother and said, I have a personal interest in this, I'm a brother, I'm a co-tenant, and I own this part, and here's my lawyer, and y'all go do battle, that would be fine. And in answer to a question you spoke of earlier, everybody agreed that Lewis McCall would be a suitable substitute executive. Nobody had any problems with it.
Who is that?
Ms. Kappas' brother-in-law. Everybody agreed he'd be fine. That's in the record. There was no dispute about that.
But suppose he had come in, suppose John had come in and said the estate owns 58.59%. And Sandra had come in and said, no, it owns 63.45%, which was her position, right? And the
well,
trial court
general,
says,
yes, Your Honor.
And so if John had not started at 50, if he'd started at the number that the trial court found, would that be a breach of fiduciary duty?
Well, in the sense that he continued to contend even through the appellate system that he was owed 50%.
Yeah, but if the beneficiaries had still just wanted more, and he started out where the trial court ended up, would that be a breach of fiduciary duty?
Well, I think that when you are pitted, just as a lawyer's pitted against his client, that's a breach of fiduciary position. If a partner's pitted against his partner, you can't do that.
So the answer is yes.
The answer is yes.
Some of us had Johansson during law school, and everyone who took him for Barbary, you know, treated every word he said as gospel. But it seems like you are, you and the professor are in conflict on this.
We are.
Why is he wrong?
Well, one, he's got the facts wrong. Seriously wrong. In his comment, he says that the appellate court basically affirmed all of the, upheld the independent executive decisions were upheld on every substantive issue, including the issue as to prorative ownership of the land. That's not true. Okay? They still came to the appellate court claiming 50%, page 6 of their brief in the appellate court. Ultimate justice would require that the estate share be held to be 50%, leaving John his 50% share. Johannesson further says the central issue was whether the estate owned 58.59 or 63.45. That wasn't the central issue. The central issue was this contract of sale that and the inventory and appraisal that was going to divide the proceeds 50-50. The hearing was so contentious that the judge forced Mr. Kappas, through his lawyer, to admit that the single-wide mobile home had been a gift from the partnership. He either had to admit that they'd been committing fraud on the taxing authority, or it was a gift, and they chose gift. The title to the mobile home was in the estate's name. The title of the double-wide was in the estate's name. That's in the record. There were disputes about the improvements, but clearly the porches, and there are appraisals in here that they put into evidence that the land was only worth $70,000.
Let's get back to the independent executor. If we'd have had a different independent executor put in, they would have picked a number, and y'all both would have sued them anyway. And the only difference would have been would have had somebody extra charging fees. Why is that better?
Well, Your Honor, the reason it's better is that the estate would not be paying Mr. Kappas' private attorney's fees, which they've done so far, okay, which I think is a blatant conflict of interest, and he would have had to pay them privately, and it would have been a private dispute between the beneficiaries.
Well, doesn't the statute allow for payment of his attorney's fees in this case?
It's up to the trial court.
Well, I thought there's one of them that says shall and one of them says may. Your client may get her attorney's fees. He shall get his. Am I misremembering the statute?
I didn't study up on that, Judge.
I have another question, though. Is there a difference between a conflict of interest and a breach of fiduciary duty?
I don't think so.
Okay, so you're saying the fact that their positions might be, he might take a different position than the estate, so that there is the potential for a disevaluation or a different evaluation, is the same thing as an actual position taken that's different.
I think there has to be an actual position taken that's different.
Okay, so it's not a breach simply to have the conflict.
No, it's not a breach simply to own the property in co-tenancy.
And it's not a breach for him to be executor if there is the potential that he is going to evaluate it differently than your client. Just the potential.
I don't think so, no.
It's when he actually makes the evaluation with which she disagrees that your position is he's breached, when there's actual action taken.
That's correct.
How about a step further, then? It's a friendly dispute. Instead of hating each other, okay, they just have a friendly disagreement. I think I'm entitled to 58%. You think you're entitled to 62%. Tell you what, let's take this to the judge, and we'll each pay our own lawyer, so let's take the attorney's fees issue out of it. And whoever wins, wins. Will we have to remove the executor then?
No.
And so the difference is whether the people hate each other or not.
No, Your Honor. No, because what I said a minute ago, Judge.
This sounds exactly like my hypothetical, except the people hate each other.
No, Your Honor. What I said earlier was if he was there as a private individual, as a co-tenant, and she was there representing...
The only reason he's not is because of the attorney's fees.
I don't know why they did that. I mean, that issue has not been addressed by the trial court.
My hypothetical, if you have a friendly dispute, you'd both be there individually.
We'd both be there individually, but the only difference is
the hate and who pays the attorney's fees, which, as I understand it, is the trial judge can decide. The trial judge can decide whether he's acting in good faith as an executor or selfishly as an individual and adjust his fees accordingly, right?
Sure.
So Why is my friendly hypothetical dispute any different from this one?
Well, because once you have a breach of fiduciary duty, you can't unring the bell. Okay, it's done. You can't undo it.
But you don't think there's a breach of fiduciary duty if it's an honest, good faith mistake? I think this is it, and you think that's it.
See, in your hypothetical, Your Honor, what you're doing is you're taking the executor out of the equation, and you're taking the executor over here and say you sit on the sidelines.
No, I'm assuming
while these
he's
people fight.
I'm assuming he is the executor, and he says, you know, we just have an honest disagreement as to how to split up these assets. We need the judge to settle this. So he goes in as executor and is his own self, saying, I think I'm entitled to more than she thinks I'm going to get. She thinks otherwise. We just need you to decide this, Judge.
No, I don't think you can do that.
Then
I don't think he can do that, Judge.
Can't even do that.
It's a Judge. It is, Your Honor. It's a conflict of interest. It is a breach of fiduciary duty. It's a very tenet of probate law.
Well, wait,
and fiduciary relationships.
I thought you just said there's a difference between a conflict of interest and a breach of fiduciary duty.
I said they're the same.
They're the same.
Yeah.
Okay. So when he takes it, when he has an interest, and his brother appoints him as executor, and there, he's got an interest. That is a conflict of interest at that point. It seems like
potential.
A potential.
But are you asking for a categorical rule that nobody can ever be an executor if they claim an ownership interest in the estate?
No.
Only when they assert an interest, or when does it become?
When they assert, when an individual that is not a beneficiary asserts a private claim to more of the estate than the and against the beneficiaries.
And does it matter one iota, in your view, whether James knew about this potential conflict when he appointed his brother?
I think that's why he appointed an alternative executor that was Sandy's brother.
Why isn't this case controlled by Boyles versus Gresham? You familiar with that case?
No, Your Honor.
We said in 1958 that an assertion of a claim against the estate under the will, which is a conflict of interest potential, would not render the named independent executor unsuitable for that office.
Well, and I think that was addressed in Sammons versus Elder talks about that case, I think the distinction is about beneficiaries, whether there's beneficiaries feuding versus an outside party feuding.
Well, you've got the named executor who's also got a claim against the estate. Isn't that what we have here?
That is what we have here.
And we said in that case that doesn't make him unsuitable.
Well, unsuitability is different than this situation. Unsuitability is where you qualify, but it is less of a burden, Your Honor. Unsuitability is. There have been many cases written.
So then you would say he may be suitable, but he's removable because of the conflict.
He's removable because of the conflict, and also because he's in violation of 149C2. Okay.
What's the value of this? $110,000?
That's all it is, Judge. When Ms. Kappas and her two small children walked in my office, I never dreamed I'd be before this honorable court.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting issue, but it's, from a practical standpoint, it seems, you know, maybe perhaps money not well spent. We're only talking about maybe 50% of that or 60% of $110,000.
Well, Ms. Kappas and I have been friends a long time, Your Honor. So
that's none of my business. But it seemed like something could have been resolved maybe at a mediation.
We weren't able to get there, Your Honor.
On the valuation, the ownership problem, that nobody has challenged the Court of Appeals ruling on that, so that's over.
That's over, Your Honor. I think that's a factual dispute that this court's not going to hear anyway.
So are there other grounds for alleging a conflict or breach of fiduciary duty?
No.
So if we were looking at it now, there isn't a conflict. take your position that you can't unring the bell, but the bell's not going to ring anymore, I guess, to follow through.
Well, it could as long as he's a trustee.
Right, but it'd be something new.
That's true, Your Honor.
There was a reference to handling the debt on a vehicle, and I couldn't be clear exactly what else, but I take it all of that's kind of gone away, and we're really here on the conflict breach fiduciary question.
I think the central issue is the conflict and the breach of fiduciary duty and the 149C2. I think those are the primary issues.
So why isn't it more of a declaratory judgment? He should or shouldn't have been removed, but the property's been adjudicated. So why is it not an advisory opinion?
Well, the property wasn't adjudicated until we got to Tyler.
But, I mean, that's done, and that's not contested.
That's true.
So whatever we say about the removal is just sort of advisory, isn't it? Because it doesn't make any difference to the disposition.
No, the estate still needs to be administered, John.
But you're not claiming a conflict as to other estate assets.
No, Your Honor, we're not.
Has the mandate gone from the Court of Appeals ordering his removal yet?
It was sent, and then they timely perfected this appeal.
But
they usually don't send them if they perfect appeal.
It was very close.
But
time-wise. At least that's my remembrance. Okay.
Clear, your position is, since he did have a conflict and he did breach his fiduciary duty, even though all the other matters have been resolved, he still should be removed.
I don't think you can undo the bell.
Right.
And that's Uturi versus Uturi. And this court's written on fiduciary duty I don't know how many times. And you know, the problem is, okay, if we're gonna say, gosh, it's okay to breach it a little bit, and then you'd fight it all the way to the Court of Appeals and resolve it, and now it's okay. I don't know what kind of message that sends to the practitioners across the state of Texas about what fiduciary duty really means.
It's a bit unclear to me as I read the CA opinion, which of the factors in 149C they sort of shoehorn conflict of interest into. It seems to be A5, which is the gross misconduct or gross mismanagement and performance of those executor duties. But do you have any insight on that?
Well, I think they weren't very clear, and that's another problem with the good professor's analysis of the case, because he obviously hadn't
seen. I'm talking about the Court of Appeals analysis.
I know. The Court of Appeals analysis, they lump it all together, Your Honor, and they talk. Their main decision is about the property, but they lump in the $4,000 issue over the car and not sending the letter to the secured creditors. They lump in the conflict of interest, and they lump in the 149C2.
Well, it mentions that, you know, John's, you know, shared ownership of this property creates a conflict, and under these circumstances, the trial court had no alternative but to remove him as executor. I'm just trying to figure out which of the factors in the statute do you sort of where do you shoehorn conflict of interest in these factors that are laid out in the statute?
Well, you shoehorn it in under the 149C2, which is the attempted misapplication of funds, and Section 5, and the case law that talks about fiduciary duty that the Court of Appeals cites, Hitt versus Hitt, and the other cases cited there. And the other cases that they've cited talk about separate versus community and husband and wife, and those issues arising, and the executor should be removed, and there's a litany of cases there that talk about that. But our main thrust is those two sections in the probate code, and that once it occurs, I mean, I don't know if I breach a fiduciary duty to my client, and he sues me, and I say, oh, gosh, I was wrong. Here's your money. I think I'm still in breach of my fiduciary duty. I mean, that's the tension in this case, and I think it is an important case to define that relationship of the testator and the executor and the fiduciary duty when these conflicts arise.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Court will hear rebuttal.
We give our trial courts great discretion in making decisions. I think that's good. How is this such a clear abuse of discretion that the trial court's decision needs to be, well, we're obviously reviewing it, but needs to be changed?
Actually, Your Honor, I'm here.
It seems like the matter's worked out.
I'm here in support of the trial court's decision. I think the trial court made the correct decision that there were insufficient grounds under the statutes and the case law for removal. The court that erred is the 12th Court of Appeals in Tyler by making blanket statements that John's shared ownership of the real estate creates a conflict of interest. The mere joint ownership of estate property by itself is not grounds for removal.
Is there a difference in your mind between the conflict or potential conflict of interest in joint ownership and breach of fiduciary duty?
Yes, there's a big difference, Your Honor.
And your position is it takes an actual breach.
Yes. Professor Johansson states that in his outline and in his annotated commentary to the Texas Probate Code, which refers to an old case from 1953 in New York, in Ray Foss's will, which we've cited in the briefs, which says the joint ownership or a potential conflict is not enough. It should only be, the standard for removal should be actual misconduct, not just a conflict of interest on its face.
But an actual conflict is a breach of fiduciary duty, isn't it? I mean, as a fiduciary, you're supposed to put the person you have the duty to, their interest above your own. So if you're asserting an interest that conflicts with that, isn't that, by definition, a breach of fiduciary duty?
Justice O'Neill, in probate practice, where we appoint family members, where we name family members in our wills and in our trusts, we kind of have to take the good with the bad. We have to accept that a lot of these people are going to have a potential conflict.
Potential. I'm talking about an actual conflict. And once he asserted more than 50% ownership, then isn't that an actual conflict?
Your Honor, he never asserted more than 50%. He just said, we were partners, we were brothers, we owned everything together. In his inventories that he filed with the probate court pursuant to his duties as executor and trustee, he just characterized the property as jointly owned 50%. And that's, the disagreement was only over the value.
Well, but I get, let me rephrase my question then. If his claim of 50% is not an accurate reflection that doesn't take into account the improvements on the property, and he is therefore, by getting 50%, getting more than he's entitled to, isn't that an actual conflict, not a potential one?
Under these circumstances, he did not appeal the judge's resolution of that issue, and so the matter was resolved in his mind, and he could proceed with the administration of the estate and fund the trust for these two kids, Casey and James, that he's, you know, sworn to take care of.
Who's administering the estate now?
It's basically locked up. The litigation has continued unabated during the appeal, and it's just at a standstill awaiting the decision of this court. We would respectfully pray that this honorable court issue an opinion and reverse and render the Tyler Court of Appeals and let stand the trial court's decision and let stand the time-tested Texas probate jurisprudence and the statutory law that the testator, Jim here, gets to pick who he wants to be his executor. And I believe Justice Willis stated it correctly that Boyles versus Gresham controls here, and that is a long-standing rule in Texas probate jurisprudence that we try to follow the intent of the testator, and even if the testator made a bad choice, we're charged with trying to follow what they wanted done.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and that concludes arguments for this morning. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.